This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. The internet is so ingrained in our daily lives that it can be hard to remember life before it. And it changes so quickly, it's equally hard to know what the future might hold. One thing that's clear is that more and more people will be connected and doing more and different things with this technology. Later this hour, we'll hear from one scientist who's helping develop a vision for the future structure of the internet to help make sure there are as many open options as possible. Also, Open Cape, a homegrown initiative to bring high-speed, reliable broadband access to everyone on the Cape and Islands. First, though, we take a step back into internet history. It can be difficult to nail down the date the internet began. Was it when the technology was first invented, when the first email was sent, or when the network was first made available to the public? What we know for sure is that 20 years ago this week, Brewster Kahle started archiving the internet. Kahle is a computer engineer, internet activist, and a digital librarian. He's founder of Internet Archive, and he joins me now by Skype from San Francisco. Brewster Kahle, welcome to Living Lab.
Oh, good to be here.
Now, the Internet Archive, just based on that name, could be a couple of things. Is it an archive of the internet, or is an archive of a lot of different things that happens to live on the internet?
We started by being an archive of the internet, and specifically of the World Wide Web. But as that moved along, we found that there were other things that we could really do to bring the wealth of published materials to everybody by being an archive on the internet.
And I understand Internet Archive is actually housed in an old church. There's got to be a story there.
Yes. So the Internet Archive strives to be help build the whole internet into the Library of Alexandria version 2. Can we make all the published works of humankind, books, music, video, web pages, software, available to anybody that wants to have access? Universal access to all knowledge. And our logo was kind of a little Parthenon-looking thing, sort of drawing back on the Greek ideals of the Library of Alexandria, which is located in Egypt. But it was sort of a project by the sort of Greeks working with the Egyptians thousands of years ago. And so when this building came for sale, we went and looked at it and said, that's our logo. And it was, you know, with the pillars and the whole thing. And it was an old Christian Science church. And so we thought this would be a fabulous place to make our home after 15 years of living with this logo.
That's just it must have been meant to be.
Yes.
Take us back to, I'm guessing it was more than 20 years ago. What was going on when you first decided that you needed to start archiving the web? What drove the idea of the Internet Archive?
It goes back for me much further than that, about 1980. The idea was floating around that we should be able to have the Library of Congress on our desktop. And, you know, this was days when there were mini computers and they were dreadful and only used by professionals pretty much. It was before PCs were out. But this idea was floating around. So I thought, okay, how hard could that be? And so I started working away on some of the pieces that would be required. We needed computers. I worked and helped try to get supercomputers so that could actually handle that much data. Once we had that so we could search effectively, then we needed a mechanism of distributing this over the ARPANET at the time. And so I did a system called Waze. In 1989, the idea was to help publishers and everybody become a publisher. And that really took root with the World Wide Web. And by 94, 95, we had publishing up and running on this new infrastructure. Then we could turn to build the library. So by 1996, there was enough going on that we could actually archive every web page from every website every 2 months. Kind of like what the search engines were doing. Take a snapshot, then another snapshot, and another snapshot, and we've been doing that for 20 years. The idea is to build a library of what people have put on the internet, on the World Wide Web. And it's turned out to be fantastically popular, and it's getting to be huge. There's about 500 take just pages, 265 billion pages that we've archived. And if you count all the GIFs and all the JPEGs, it's over 500 billion.
So do you have all of the, you know, LOL cats and all of those memes and all of that great stuff is archived for eternity?
Yes, we certainly have a lot of cats. But we also have a lot of news reports and press releases, people's home pages. We probably have the president's webpage, whoever's going to be president in 20 years. We probably have her website when she's in high school.
I know that you have actually a blog that I wrote for a year and a half that, through a series of mishaps, was lost to the rest of the web. But through part of the Internet Archive, which you call the Wayback Machine, I can go type in that URL and go surf through the blog like it's today. It's a fabulous feature to be able to look back, but it's also got to be funny sometimes to look back at how quaint the internet was when it was getting started 15 or 20 years ago.
Yes, if you go to archive.org, there's a free service where you can type in a URL. And some people just type in things like Yahoo or their alma mater or their old website, just to see sort of what the evolution has been over time. But the average life of a web page is about 100 days before it's either changed or deleted. So web pages are really ephemeral. Even though we use this metaphor of page that sounds like books, that sounds like permanent, it just really isn't. And everybody's kind of like you, and it's actually pretty hard to go and archive your old stuff. It's not like you can just print it out and put it on the shelf and have it be really useful later. It's not, if it's not online, it's as if it doesn't exist, and things don't last online very long.
In addition to websites, what else is in the archive at this point?
Oh, you should try checking out the television archive. So tv.archive.org, or you can go to archive.org and go to the TV section. And it is amazing what it is you can see. So you can go and search based on what people have said on US television news since mid-2009. So if you just type Snowden or Donald Trump or something that you're interested in, you can see when those occurrences of those words and phrases have been over time, and filter it by either by channel or by program, and be able to zoom in and get clips of what it is people have said so that we can think critically about what's going on television. Otherwise, it just goes running along. If you can't quote, compare, and contrast, then you can't think critically. You can't go and remember and put it back out there and say, maybe that wasn't so right. So television is there. Music, movies, I can keep going.
Sounds like a fabulous tool for modern historians.
Oh, yes. It's or just general end users. People just use it to, well, we have our music collection is, we started by collecting concert recordings from taper-friendly bands like the Grateful Dead. And there are now 6,000 bands that have said yes to being archived, and we have 130,000 concerts that are available in the highest quality form of lossless compressed FLAC files, of WAV files, that these are available for free enjoying. It's a library. We now have millions of books available. Openlibrary.org is another website that we maintain that has millions of old books, sort of pre-1923, but also modern books that you can borrow for free. So you can go and find of about 300,000 books to go and borrow for 2 weeks, read it on your screen, or you can download it to another device.
This word free that you're using a lot is kind of a hot button thing on the internet right now. I mean, everybody in theory thinks it would be great to have free and open access to all of the knowledge of the world, but then how would publishers get paid? How would TV stations get paid? Are there copyright issues? Can you get around paywalls and sign-ins by going to archive.org? And are there issues there?
We can't get around paywalls by going to the Wayback Machine, for instance. If it's behind a paywall, then actually we can't get it, which is real tragedy. But the libraries have always bought materials from publishers and then made them available to the public. And the key thing is publishers and libraries have always worked in parallel. The library system in the United States is about a $12 billion a year industry. About $3 to $4 billion of that goes to publishers' products. I don't suggest we actually spend any less than that. I just suggest we spend it better, that we actually use these our precious public dollars to go and make materials available on screens now. So the Internet Archive acquires these materials either through donations, depends on what type of materials, and then we make them available in ways that don't interrupt commerce. So it actually it's of helpful for researcher use. Watching news from 5 years ago is not the most commercially a viable thing, but libraries can spend their time and efforts to make a researcher tool for people to sort of understand who we are, what we are, by reusing these materials in a new and different way.
The ability to go back and look at how the internet has changed, or just to have this access to so much knowledge, music, content, whatever it is that you're looking for, is a boon on one hand. On the other hand, there's a growing idea about the right to be forgotten. The idea that, especially when it comes to social media or photos that have ended up on the web, or you know, perhaps the future president's website from high school, that maybe these are things that we don't want archived for all time. Is there a downside to this activity?
It is changing what it is, how available information is, and that's unsettling and also wonderful at the same time. It is an adjustment. So the Internet Archive, when we're crawling the World Wide Web, we don't want the materials that other people don't want there. So if people don't want their website in that, you can indicate that with robot exclusions, or you can write to us and we take it back down. And that does happen a lot, because not a lot of what's posted on the World Wide Web is not meant for the ages, and it's not meant for everybody. Things like Facebook actually make it very difficult to archive those sorts of things, and maybe in some senses, those are often private conversations. So we don't archive things that aren't publicly available at one point. And even if after the fact, if you say, well, that was kind of when I was married and now I'm divorced and I'd like to not have that up anymore, we will take things out of the Wayback Machine.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is Brewster Kahle. He's founder of Internet Archive. Brewster, you mentioned the need to spend some of our precious public dollars on essentially librarian activities. How is Internet Archive funded?
We're an independent library, so we're not part of the government or part of a university or a school. So we're in sort of the old tradition of libraries. And we get most of our money by libraries paying us 10 cents a page for digitizing books, which we do at about 1,000 books a day. And we also get paid by libraries to build special collections of web pages on their behalf. And then that covers about 2/3. And then the rest comes from foundations and the end of the year donations. So as people get library cards, they can sign up to a newsletter. And like NPR, we at the end of the year, we send out a few emails to say, please think about donating to the Internet Archive. And people do.
In addition to your work as perhaps the ultimate digital librarian, you're an advocate of universal access of a free and open web, and you've said you want to lock the web open. What does that mean?
Well, Snowden has really pointed out that we've got some problems with the current web infrastructure. We've had people trust this infrastructure and put their lives and their thoughts in this open environment. But it's also become a large surveillance network where you can actually know much more than what people were intending to make available. And that's going on by the United States government and by corporations and by others. So we've really found that we've got a problem in some of the architecture of the World Wide Web. So the thought was, can we go and build on the World Wide Web and make it so that it has a couple of new attributes that Tim Berners-Lee didn't put in the original? So can we make it reliable so that it is you can make sure that you can still get at old pages, that they don't just blink on and off the web. Or if you happen to be in China, that you can't go and see large sections of the World Wide Web like the New York Times or anything on archive.org. Can we make it so that the web is reliable? Can we make it so that it's private? So your reader privacy, what it is you're reading, can't be snooped on. What we found is those that read WikiLeaks were recorded, who they were, by the British intelligence agency, and those were handed over to the NSA. And the NSA had discussions of whether they should use that to do heightened investigations of those people as persons of interest. This is there's a long history in the library world of people being rounded up for what they've read and bad things happening to them. And the World Wide Web structure, unfortunately, doesn't have protections against this. So the idea was to try to build on the existing web and see if we can make it so that we can lock the web open. Can we make it so that openness is irrevocable, that we bake the First Amendment into the code itself? Can we make it so that we have a reliable infrastructure? And we have the technology now to be able to do this, but do we have the will to go and upgrade the World Wide Web? And we're hoping and trying.
Is this a matter of software, of technology, of laws? What's actually involved in this idea of locking the web open?
There was a gathering at the Internet Archive with Vint Cerf, the founder of the Internet, one of the founders of the Internet. There's Tim Berners-Lee, a number of the head of the Mozilla, the Firefox organization, plus a pile of other people to try to figure out what we should do. And we think there's a technology fix, actually, to help upgrade. So we could use peer-to-peer technology to go and make it so that websites live everywhere and nowhere. So you could actually make it so that even if one part of the web goes down, one machine on the web, the materials are still available. This would be a great boon for reliability. And this technology could be done compatibly so that you could just use your existing web browser and the web would just get better.
That's Bruce Drakeil. He's a computer engineer, internet activist, and digital librarian, founder of the Internet Archive, which turns 20 years old this week. Brewster, thanks so much, and congratulations on 20 years of the Internet Archive.
Thank you very much. Please visit archive.org and openlibrary.org.
Next up, we'll talk to one scientist helping envision the future of the internet, the actual physical computers and infrastructure that underlies the World Wide Web. That's coming up when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We tend to think about the internet in terms of the content that we read or post. What most of us don't think about is how the structure of the internet impacts how we use it and what we're able to do. David Clark, on the other hand, has spent the last few decades thinking about exactly that issue. He's a senior research scientist at MIT with the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, or CSAIL. He's co-director of the MIT Communications Futures Program and one of the organizers of the National Science Foundation's Future Internet Architecture Project. David Clark, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
Now, when we talk about the architecture of the internet, what does that phrase actually mean?
Let me make a very basic distinction. You were getting at it in your introduction. Users of the internet tend to think of the internet as the totality of the experience. They use Facebook, they use Twitter, they use email. But to those of us who designed the internet, those are applications. I guess in the current jargon, they're apps. And they run on top of what I call the internet. The internet is a very simple data transport mechanism between computers. You put the bytes in one side and they come out the other side. And the idea of that service is you can build anything on top of it. So to me, the architecture of the internet are those principles that define how it moves data from one point to another. And the generality of that architecture is what lets other people build on top of it, the World Wide Web, email, games, and so forth.
Speaking of principles of the internet, you are known as one of the fathers of the internet's end-to-end principle. What is that?
It's actually a reflection of the architectural approach I just described. It was important in the design of the internet that the internet not know what you're trying to do. If the boxes that make up the internet, the little computers, well, they're big computers these days, they're called routers, and they forward data from place to place. if they knew what you were trying to do, they knew you were using Facebook, they knew you were using Twitter, and in some sense they facilitated that, then to add a new application to the internet, you'd have to go modify all those boxes, which is unthinkable. There's millions of them. So the end-to-end principle basically said that it was the endpoints of the communication. The computer at the source might be the computer on your desk. The computer at the destination might be a web server. They are the ones who are responsible for implementing what you are trying to do. We take the functionality, we push it out to the edges, and we leave what's going on in the center, this minimum capability, which is a general platform, but is in fact intentionally ignorant of what you're trying to do.
David, why is this architecture, this idea of end-to-end or pushing most of the functionality to the edges of the network, why is that important for everyday users of the internet to understand?
Well, it's a facilitation of innovation. Now, the end user may not long for the application that doesn't exist yet, but we feel that the richness of the internet experience is clearly enhanced by the idea that anybody can come along and build an application. You don't have to get permission. You don't have to get a license. You just do it. You know, Facebook comes out of somebody's dorm room. There are other reasons as well that have to do with the industry structure. Most people today have broadband internet access in their home. Let's set wireless aside for a moment. And there are a small number of companies that are delivering internet service. There's probably a cable company in your area. There's probably a telephone company in your area, but they're not 10. And there's an interesting question about the industry structure, market power, and so forth. The Federal Communications Commission has actually been working quite hard to impose rules that say that your internet service providers can't block or discriminate against any particular application you're trying to use. But if the network actually knew what applications you were using, it would be much harder to say, no, no, that's not the responsibility or the domain of the internet service provider. That's the responsibility of the application builder. So one answer to your question is innovation and this constant explosion of new applications, which you can sample and either like or not. And the other has to do with industry structure.
And it sounds like also personal privacy.
Well, that's a complicated one. The relationship of the end-to-end principle and privacy and security is, let me just say, multidimensional. Clearly, the internet service provider can see what you're doing, unless, of course, you've chosen to use protocols that encrypt your communication. And there is a push today to encourage the use of encryption on the internet. The push, I think, comes less from concerns about the internet service providers than concerns about possible excessive intervention by intelligence agencies and so forth. That's a very contentious area. With respect to security, people have argued that if the network knew more about what you were trying to do, maybe it could keep bad things from happening. That's arguable. It's not clear.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with David Clark of MIT about the design of the internet and how it affects everyday users. David, let's take a big step back to, say, 25 years ago. Public access to the internet is just getting started. What did the internet, for lack of a better term, what did it look like at that point?
Well, I think an interesting place to go back to, I think you went about the right distance, the mid to late 1980s. At that point, the only application that everyday users were using is email. And to say you were on the internet meant that you had an email address and you were very forward-looking if you printed it on your business card. The World Wide Web did not come along until 1990. The typical user was not a user in home, although some people did have very slow-speed, what was called dial-up modems at the time. Most users at that point were using the internet from their office, a place of work, where we had higher bandwidth connectivity. Basically, the personal computer was transforming the internet during the 1980s. In the 1970s, we thought we were hooking up large mainframes that were in large rooms with operators to tend them. And then the personal computer came along in the early 1980s, and it became clear that the future of the internet was very small computers belonging to everybody. But that hadn't really penetrated the world. So I think the major milestones in this space are the personal computer and local area network in the 1980s, the emergence of the web in 1990 as the next major application. All of a sudden, the internet was not email. The internet was the World Wide Web. That was clear by 1995. And then in 2000, you see the home dial-up modem being replaced by broadband service.
And now we have everybody with not only a small computer, relatively speaking, in their home, but an even smaller computer, their cell phone, in their pocket. How much have mobile devices changed the internet, how we use it, and also what we would define as the architecture or the shape of the internet?
Well, the phone in your pocket runs the exact same protocols as the computer on your desk. The data is still broken into these chunks, which we call packets, and they have addresses on the front, and they show up in your phone. I think in the United States, because we had wireline service first, a lot of the high-end experiences that we have, like everybody watching Netflix today, you can't quite yet do that over the cellular system. The answer to your question actually varies much from country to country. If you go to the developing world, the majority of the internet experience is being defined by the smartphone, the device in your pocket. Wireline connections are actually very rare. I think in this country, most people have both, and they've learned that since cellular actually has usage limits, they often wait till they get home or get to the office so their phone can be hooked up over their wireline system using Wi-Fi. I think wireless is tremendously exciting. It's clearly made the internet available everywhere. I confess, at my age, which is 72, I'm surprised to see people walking down the street staring at their cell phone and tripping over fire hydrants. It's just a little culturally odd for me, but obviously always connected has taken on a new dimension of always.
In talking about the spread of internet to everywhere, and in particular to developing nations, I wonder if we're using the wrong word. I mean, to talk about the internet as a single network, is that really what the future of the internet is, or should we be speaking in the plural here about internets?
Well, for the moment, it's still one interconnected system at the packet forwarding level. I can send a poor packet from a computer here at MIT, and it ends up at a computer in China, and that works just fine. What I called earlier the internet experience is becoming much more diverse, and in some respects, that's merely obvious. Applications are being localized to different languages. They're being localized to different cultural expectations. I'm disappointed when there are countries that actually block the option of a global internet experience. China blocks access to Facebook. They block access to Twitter. They have domestic equivalents. I don't think we should have any complaint if the Chinese citizen chooses to use a domestic alternative to Facebook. I would prefer that they be able to use Facebook for a global experience if they choose to. But it only makes sense that the experience has become localized. People shop locally, they shop in their own language, they speak in their own language, they communicate with their friends. So I think the experience is becoming localized, but for the moment, the packet support, the supporting system that moves packets of data around, that still is a single global system, and with luck, it'll stay that way.
We started off talking about the end-to-end principle, marginalizing, not in a bad way, pushing functionality to the edge of the network. Is that still, you think, the best design? That was the design envisioned 25 or even 40 years ago. Or given what we now have in terms of technology and the ways that we use the web, would you envision the architecture of the internet differently?
That's a very interesting question, and opinions differ. The National Science Foundation, over the last 10 years, encouraged the networking research community to envision what an internet of 15 years from now might look like if you were unconstrained by the necessity of being compatible with the existing internet. They said, free your mind and just envision alternative futures. And very different futures came up. Some were, I would say, very minimalist in terms of what's in the center of the network. Some moved a lot of function into the internet itself, the routers, these devices that forward packets. There were a variety of arguments in favor of moving function into the network, one of which was better support for mobility. On the other hand, I think the idea that the development of applications should be divorced from the functions that are in the network so that, again, we keep open this opportunity of the invention of new applications without having to modify the core of the network. I think that is still a very persistent value. What we do see is applications being redesigned so that instead of a message going from my computer to your computer, they're now going to massive servers. The word cloud is sometimes used to describe these. When you talk to Facebook, you talk to the Facebook server. But again, the internet designers would say, well, that's fine. That's just a very large computer somebody attached to the internet. It's none of my business. We just had to put in a really big fiber.
The National Science Foundation Future Internet Archives Project is attempting to engage a broad swath of society in thinking about the future of the internet, not just technologists, not just industry, but also lawyers and a variety of others from what you might call, I guess, civil society or the rest of the public. What kind of responses have you gotten?
Well, first of all, I was delighted to have NSF actively encourage the participation of those people in our design process in our meetings. I think it was an incredibly fruitful activity. Yes, we did have lawyers. We had social scientists of various kinds. We had sociologists. We had ethicists. And we had some wonderful conversations with them. But again, I think we struggled a little bit in the conversation. And the reason we struggled was that the distinction I'm making here, which is makes perfect sense to a technologist, the packet carriage service is built by one set of actors, the internet experience is designed by another set of actors. That distinction was problematic in these conversations because what they wanted to talk about was the totality of the internet experience. And we would keep trying to modularize that experience, and they would keep saying, well, we have to think about it as a holistic thing. I think we made a great deal of progress in those conversations, and I think the technology community was broadened and enlightened by having those people in the room. But in the end, what I concluded, and I spent quite a bit of time analyzing what happened in these projects, it wasn't this basic, what I'm calling internet service, that was influencing some of the concerns that that broader community, the social science community, brought to the table. Those concerns were really positioned at the higher levels in the system, which is the design of the applications, it's the design of the Facebook, it's the design of Google, and so forth. So I think the lesson that came out of this is that, in fact, the distinctions are somewhat robust, but unfortunately, you can't change the internet experience. It's like saying, can I change the kind of cars I can buy by changing the road? And it's just it's a very weak lever you have to pull on. Obviously, if the road didn't admit cars that were more than 3 feet wide, we'd have very different cars. But the road can't stop getaway cars, and the road was intended to be general. All kinds of vehicles drive on the road. No, you can't drive tanks on the road, so there are limits. And you really sort of think about the internet the same way. Somebody who called the internet the information superhighway, and I hated that phrase when it came out, actually gave us a good image, because I like to explain to people there's only so much you can do to shape society's use of the highway system by the design of the roads. And, you know, yeah, you put in a superhighway or you don't, all these, you have some controls, but that's not the best place you get control if you're worried about things like drunk drivers.
Continuing that analogy, do you think we need to reimagine, as you mentioned earlier, you know, if we had no constraints, reimagine how we design the internet, the roads, the superhighway? Do we actually need to do that? Or perhaps do we have the right design, and where we should be putting our focus is on designing that user experience, the internet experience?
Well, I'm going to waffle a little bit on that. When NSF started this Future Internet Project, nobody thought there would be the day of the great unplugging when we all turned off the internet and turned on another net. The internet is so deeply embedded in our world that it's really hard to imagine just a wholesale replacement. What we assumed was that if we encouraged people to think freely about the future and good ideas emerged, that what we could do is work those ideas into the current internet and push the current internet in one direction relative to another. And I think you see some of that happening. So I become very pragmatic, having told the research community, go forth and think freely. Now we have to come back to what's going to happen. And what's going to happen is that the internet's going to evolve. And I hope we have shaped the direction of evolution a little bit. But there are lots of forces that push on the evolution of the internet, and many of them are very powerful commercial forces. And you see government coming in with regulatory forces and so forth. So there are a lot of issues here. It's become very much embedded in society, and you're not going to wholesale replace it any more than you're suddenly going to wholesale replace all the highways. So we have to, the best we can do, and I'm very optimistic about this, is use our insights about alternative futures to push it in a preferred direction.
David Clark is a senior research scientist with MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. He's co-director of the MIT Communications Futures Program and one of the organizers of the National Science Foundation's Future Internet Architecture Project. David, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we get an update on Cape Cod's own efforts to build a regional open network. That's Open Cape. Living Lab continues after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. You heard David Clark compare the internet to the roads that make up the information superhighway. Well, as you know, not all roads are created equal. There are pothole-riddled back roads and shiny new four-lane highways. The same is true for the wires that connect you to the web. And a lot of people are spending a lot of time and effort trying to figure out just what the best technology is and how to make sure everyone gets it. Open Cape is the Cape and Islands' own homegrown nonprofit initiative to bring broadband access to the region. Steve Johnson is chief executive and executive director at Open Cape Corporation. Steve, welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks, Heather. It's great to be here.
Can you just give us a little explanation of Open Cape, what the mission is? Is this just about being an alternative to Comcast, or is there a totally different thing driving Open Cape?
Open Cape kind of generated out of this idea back in 2006. Business leaders came together, some specific business leaders. A gentleman named Art Gaylord, who's actually the chairman of our board, was the director of IT at Woods Hole. Dan Gallagher, who was the IT director at Cape Cod Community College. Several other individuals who were kind of critical to that and said, you know, for the Cape and Islands to really flourish, to grow from economic development standpoint, we really need to have a better system to provide internet connectivity. So the idea started from there and kind of grew, and sometimes it's just better to be lucky than smart. And around the same time, there was the Broadband Technologies Opportunity Fund we could apply for, and we received this grant.
Is that a federal program?
It was a federal program. It was part of an overall economic initiative the federal government was running. And we applied for and received $32 million. The state put in $5 million. And then there was some in-kind support as well. So close to $40 million that allowed us to go out and build nearly 400 miles initially of fiber running from Brockton down across the Sagamore Bridge, back and forth across the Cape, up to P-Town, back down, out to Nantucket. We're on a microwave shot over to Martha's Vineyard, across the railroad bridge, out through Fall River, New Bedford to Providence. So we're connected in two different places. We jump on some fiber that we rent from Brockton to Boston. So we're connected in Boston and Providence, two tier one locations. So that gives us this fabulous, to use David's analogy, the superhighway. We have this autobahn of internet connectivity here on the Cape and Islands. We just have to work on building more exits to build out into communities.
What is different about the service that somebody could get through Open Cape as opposed to what you might get from a commercial provider?
Sure. Here on the Cape and Islands in particular, across the bridge in southeastern Mass, you probably have more choice. You definitely have more choice. But on the Cape and Islands, you really have one provider that provides opportunity. And unfortunately, they're just saddled with legacy systems, whether it's coaxial or copper. It simply doesn't provide the greatest opportunity, the ability to transmit data at the highest rates. Our network is 100% fiber. So basically, I can, whether you want 20 megabits per second, a gigabit, 10 gigabits, ultimately probably, you know, we'll be offering 100 gigabit connections.
I mean, who needs that kind of speed, though? I mean, are we talking about, I don't know, being able to play video games at hyper speed? But what would you be doing with that much data?
The, you know, it's an ever evolving standard. I say the exact same thing. I have 33 connected devices in my home. You know, I have 4 children right now, so they're all on their phones, their iPads. I have connected a garage door opener, all these tools. Yeah, just in case my children get locked out of the house, I can open the garage door.
To make sure you can get to your connected coffee maker.
Exactly. Connected coffee makers will all probably have Teslas and battery packs in our garages to store energy. But it is just this multitude, the Internet of Things that's coming down the road. How many people have a Nest thermostat in their home or a baby monitor? I have an infant in our house, and we have a baby monitor, so I can check on the baby no matter where I am. Those are things that will just continue. But are those really necessities? No. So when you talk about internet connectivity, from an economic standpoint, economic development standpoint, think about the people who work and live on the Cape. Think about people who work at Woods Hole. They're currently taking the 10 gigabit connection from us. Now, they don't use that all the time, but they have the availability of using that, whether they're streaming video or doing research or moving data back and forth. It allows them the ability to stay on the Cape and not have to move off Cape to get those type of services. So businesses that are offshoots of HUI, like Hydroid, typically a business like that might have went off Cape to find staff and connectivity, but now they can find those levels of connection. So it's really an economic driver here on the Cape for businesses that are currently doing business here that need to move data at a higher amount of high data rate and want the stability and the cost effectiveness of connecting to our network. So that's one of the reasons. But there's multiple applications, whether it's healthcare. You know, if your doctor's around the corner or around the world and you want to share your EKG or your cardio echo or an x-ray, you can do that. Our goal is really providing, you know, the towns, businesses, and ultimately the residents with the greatest connectivity they can get at the lowest price possible.
In terms of towns, I know emergency responders are one group that Sure. you've been working with. How would they be using Open Cape?
So when we built the Open Cape network, one of the things we did is we created a redundant microwave connection that runs from Woods Hole up through Kituit, Hyannis, Barnstable, Orleans, Harwich, and up to B-Town, just in the case, because we know the storm's going to come that takes down 300 or 400 telephone poles. We're currently on 12,000 poles on the Cape alone. So that means we can shift some of the critical load over to this microwave network that provides a redundant service for emergency first providers, the state police, all places that we're connected to currently. You know, we're currently connecting 74% of high schools on the Cape. Many of those high schools are also shelters. So in terms of a big storm or some sort of event, they would have great internet connectivity. They could broadcast from there. They could receive messages. They could do whatever they needed to do.
That's, you know, you mentioned the high schools or the schools being shelters. When they're just being schools, what are the schools using Open Cape for? What do they need that kind of connectivity for?
School connectivity, as you might imagine, is my son is a sophomore at Sandwich High School. They have just released last year, I think, 1,300 Chromebooks to their students. So these are internet-enabled devices that they're using for all their classwork. That puts a huge load on their system. So we're connected into there. They're using some of our connectivity for staff. They're using it for the students. Plus, all the students have their connected devices, their phones, their tablets, the things that they're using. And that puts a huge load. Basically, we're seeing school usage of internet double almost on an annual basis. So schools like Falmouth and Nauset and Monomoy and Sandwich are using 300 to 500 megabits of service monthly. And they'll probably increase to a gigabit in the next 12 months.
Is this something that individual residents could sign up for the same way that you would call a company and say, you know, I want your internet service. Can you call Open Cape and say, I want to be connected?
Sure, you can call Open Cape. No, I wouldn't call the phone today. And let me just clarify that. Where we are with residents right now is it simply is not economical to go out and hook up like your house, Heather, and then go down the street and hook up someone else. I have to hook up entire communities at a time.
Because of the economies of you're actually laying
we're laying
new
fiber. So it costs about $50,000 a mile to lay fiber.
So it's not just, you know, flipping on a service.
It's not something nearly as easy as coaxial cable that you might see from your local Comcast guy who's sitting outside doing it. We literally have to splice the fiber, and there's a process involved with this. So literally for the way for it to work is connecting entire communities at a time. So Earlier this summer, we launched the CrowdFiber tool on our website. If you go to opencape.org and you click on the homepage and it says, take 2 minutes to learn how to get connected, you can say, here's my address. I'm interested in learning more. You don't have to sign up or anything like that. You can just provide us your address. You're interested, and it'll map how your town is doing in comparison to all the other towns. Like Provincetown is doing shockingly well. We set the initial threshold.
And by saying shockingly well, you mean there's a lot of people who are
interested. There's a lot of interest. There's a ton of interest in Provincetown. They traditionally have had very bad service up there. There's a lot of folks that have, you know, 1 megabit down and half a megabit up.
That's, I mean, downloading and uploading.
Downloading and uploading. So the great thing about fiber connectivity is if you're getting, there's two different kinds of ways to do it. You can have symmetrical service where you always have 100 or 500 megs or a gig up and down. It's always waiting for you. A slightly cheaper version is where you can have your downloads will be faster than your uploads, and it just makes it easier. It's a little cheaper.
So assuming you're consuming more than you're publishing or putting out there.
But for some people who want, you know, they're publishing their film editors, their video editors, they're doing edits and they're uploading them to a central database, having symmetrical service is key for them. So, but Provincetown and Wellfleet and Turo and even the town of Falmouth have gone a long way in starting this process. We're 2.5-3 months into the CrowdFiber tool kind of data collection period, and we're seeing a huge response. So if someone goes to opencape.org, they can just take 2 minutes and say, hey, I'm interested in service. That doesn't mean a truck's going to show up next week, but it means that we can start really working with towns to get a better sense of what demand is, how do we pay for it, and how do we ultimately build out. There's a couple of great examples on our website, as well as like towns like Leverett, Mass, where 800 homes, they built out to every home, every business, how the financials worked. I think they ended up paying something like $24 a month plus a little tax increase for the build-out costs, and they all have like gigabit plus service.
I mean, that seems quite cheap because the cost of actually putting fiber to each home is thousands of dollars per home, right?
Yeah, trying to get that number down is the secret, and technology is changing so quickly. So you probably, if you're listening and you've been following this, you've heard of Google Fiber. Google Fiber, you know, they went out and hooked up Austin, Kansas City, a variety of other towns. And they use something called GPON, Gigabit Passive Optical Network, which is basically, it's very technical, where two fibers go into this splitter and the strands are multiplexed, so it allows you to reach more homes with two strands, and allows you as a cheaper version of deploying fiber to the home for residents. So we're going to start doing some test deployments on fiber to the home in a couple of these towns where we've got some communities, some MDUs, mixed density units, or multiple dwelling units, apartment buildings, condominiums, those type of places. We can start doing some test deployments to see how that works. And then we're going to look at broad scale rollout.
We've got just about a minute left. Sure. What's the best thing that interested community members, listeners could do to kind of help push OpenCape along?
The first thing you can do is go to our website and say, hey, I'm interested in fiber. Here's my name, address, email. That takes 2 minutes, and it's great. You can also take a speed test to see what your connectivity level is, and that's opencape.org. The other thing is you do is you can start having that conversation in your community with your selectmen, your town manager. These are conversations that we're having currently with all the towns. But you can say to them, hey, I'm really interested in having an alternative to our incumbent provider. And what's the plan? What's the broadband plan for town X or town Y? And what are we doing to compete in this next level of internet connectivity?
Steve Johnston is Chief Executive and Executive Director at Open Cape Corporation. You can find a link to that website and CrowdFiber project on our website, capeandislands.org. Steve, thanks.
Thanks, Heather.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And of course, you can find us on the web at capeandislands.org. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab is produced by Heather Goldstone and Elsa Partan. Mindy Todd is the executive producer. Major support for Living Lab comes from the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.